Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotrick are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotrick.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotrick for being a sponsor on this show. Live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the important part is the QA, SGGQA, which obviously stands for question and answers. We like to take a sort of a more interactive conversation to all the top tech news stories. I like to hold my podcast on a Monday. Gives us a little time to kind of sort out some of our feels from the week before. Maybe some news broke over the weekend or early this morning. We can get our week started off right. And I already need to throw a shout out of glory. One Mr. Dave Burns subscribed with Prime. They've been subscribed for 38 months. And this fanfare, courtesy of one Mr. Barry Johnson, is for you. Ta-da! Already getting the soundboard starting off right. I need suggestions or things for other things that we can put in here. So if there's like, what I need to do is maybe bumpers and tags. So like if there's like a news block story, we can start off like, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, breaking news. And then we can go into like the gadget block like, ha-ha, I play with toys. And then like, we can make it like an actual proper podcast. Dave, I finally got it. Hooray! Good morning. I'm already seeing a fantastic group of names in this chat right now. Marilyn just stopped by to say good morning. Good morning, Marilyn. I'm seeing Coppa Cash, seeing Gary the Fireman, Dave Burns, Al Sabakli, Go Starstream, Starscream, Words Are Hard. I said Gary, J-Man150, Jimmy Fire Dragon, ER1980, Awesome Possum, Vince Navoa, Barry Johnson. Who am I missing? I'm missing someone. There was old Trev from the Discord. Steve Pogue saying, yo, yo, yo. Ghost Starscream. Juan will never get old of that soundbar. Kind of miss the Blues Clues noises that Juan used to make. Maybe I also need to do some, like, sound effects. Like vocalizations. So, like, you know, I could bring in the Fight for Blood if we're going to talk about a really divisive. We could do the psh, 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 psh. That's what I was doing. So we could maybe also mix some of those in. This is an interactive show. If you've got suggestions or if there are some ways that you'd like to sort of see me spruce things up here. I just feel it's like about time. And Barry absolutely called it. He was like, Juan, it's about time that you actually started like Twitch correcting, like using Twitch correctly. So I'm glad he kind of nudged me along, because there's a lot of potential here and I'm very excited by it, but it is like slow going just thinking about what else to add. So yes. Let's see. Farshand Chops or Fars Hand Chops. Hey man, do you read the chat? I mean, that's what we're doing right now. Snorkel saying hi all. Bionic Scoop giving me a you. Bray Gray saying morning. Simon says hypno. I choose the hype train. Oh, we totally have to do a Ralph Wiggum in there. I love it. Love it. Yes. Correct. I'm gonna get that. I mean, that's not gonna get me like demonetized or anything, right? Having a Ralph Wiggum quote from 20 years ago. 30? Is it 30 years ago that Ralph Wiggum said, "I choose you"? Someone look that up, because I don't feel ancient enough yet already. And I think we've got this all set up here. Okay. So I hope everybody had a lovely weekend. We are in November, and I think we need to just start calling November Techtober Part 2. Like, we get through September and October, and that's sort of harvest season for the second half of the year, all of the new and exciting phone announcements, playing with Opens and Folds and Pixel Pros and iPhones and Galaxy FEs, if anyone was really hyped up about Galaxy FE. There's just so much going on, and we're now already accelerating the launch for the next year. Phones are almost becoming cars. You know, where you get your glimpse at the 2024 model, like, halfway through 2023. And they're trying to accelerate the excitement of maybe flipping a phone, just like the auto manufacturers try to front load what the next year of automobiles, I was going to say automobiles, is going to look like. And getting into, the new Xiaomi is out. We're going to be talking about the Vivo. Vivo just took the wraps off the X100 Pro. And there's just so much that's still launching. We don't really have the same kind of distinct seasons in the tech industry anymore. At the same time, I'm really trying to branch out. You know, I've been spending a lot more time with mini PCs. I've got a really funny video coming up talking about the laziest way to upgrade your NAS. And when I mean lazy, I mean, like, it's stupid. This video is going to upset people for how dumb the recommendation is, and I couldn't be more tickled by the suggestion. And before we move on, because we're going to take a little bit of a turn here for what I was doing last week, and we're going to get a little serious for just a sec, I do have to shout out McCorkerin3, also subscribed to Prime, subscribed for 28 months, over 2 years. Oh, wait. Simon Says Hypno says it was 92 for Ralph Wiggum? Is that legit? Ralph Wiggum said, "I choose you." Oh, no. Jalbotnik says, "I Love Lisa" episode was on February 11th, 1993. So we just hit this year, 30 years ago, Ralph Wiggum said, "I choose you," and now I feel ancient. But that sort of stole the wind out of the sails for what I was about to say. McCorkerin3, subscriber Prime, over 2 years. Thank you so much for all the support. I very much appreciate it. And everyone who's contributing and sharing and reviewing podcasts on your favorite podcast services, you are helping keep production going week to week. And I very much value your contributions. McCorkerin, this one's for you. Hooray! Fanfare! You know, I might actually speed it up a little bit, though. Because I did it on a MIDI, so it was like, I actually wrote that. It's terrible, right? I did the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I might just sort of shorten it a little bit, because it does kind of take its time in celebrating the individual who hit that, sharing or is subscribing on the Twitch. So, hope everybody had a lovely weekend. My week and weekend was a little tough. If you caught last Thursday's Best of Our Week, I was in a hotel room. And usually when TK or I are in hotel rooms, we're usually being kind of cagey and silly about the event that we're at that maybe we can't tell you about, or, you know, it's some kind of embargo or press event or something like that. We're going to be having another one. TK and I are going to be on location for something this next Thursday, so I'll be cagey and secretive about that, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people in this chat could probably guess where we might be. But we'll be there together, because we're best buds like that. So last week was not one of those. Last week... And you'll pardon, because I don't tend to share a lot of stuff personally, but this one kind of dovetails into some of the conversations that I've had about smartphones and cameras. We suffered a loss in the Bagnell family. And my cousin Phil passed away at the age of 39. He was one of the younger members of our little chunk of the family. Because, you know, like, a larger family, like my dad's side of the family. It's a really huge family. It's hilarious, and it's spread out all over the country, all over the world. And, you know, you kind of have like the aunts and uncles that kind of came up at one time, and the aunts and uncles that were maybe a little bit younger. And there was like a wave of kids, and Phil was sort of on the younger side of that group. He was younger than me. And that really hurts. I mean, it just really hurts to see someone that young pass away. And he was one of those gregarious, smart, funny guys that really kind of stepped into a leadership role in our generation, where us older cousins, me and my cousin Joe, came first, and we were the ones that were often, you know, kind of leading the way. As we all kind of grew up, Phil kind of took on that sort of ambassador role. He was just effortlessly charismatic and welcoming. So that really hurt. It really hurt the whole family. Leading up to the memorial last week and spending some time with family over the weekend, I was really upset about the loss, but also just really upset that my role has kind of become documentarian of my family. I've talked so much about using your phone to create these memories or edit these videos, or maybe you want to build a NAS instead of relying on cloud storage, or not using the photo gallery in Facebook because it's so much harder to actually really kind of share things with different family members. And I couldn't find any of my photos or videos of Phil. And it was killing me. Even up to the memorial service, I was despondent. Everybody's like kind of sharing these memories and sharing these stories. And I'm not actually the most outgoing in my family. Phil and I, we weren't the closest of cousins, but I mean, we loved each other. We enjoyed hanging out for those few times that we would. He was out on the East Coast. I was out on the West Coast. When you come from a military family and you're moving around a lot, it's really hard to kind of keep up a constant relationship with someone. But Phil was one of those guys where years could go by and then you'd meet up with him, grab a beer, and like you're just immediately falling back into the same conversation you ended like 3 years prior. And so I had these photos from some of our Christmas events. We would have like a family reunion every other Christmas. I couldn't find anything of Phil. So I'm sitting at this memorial service and I'm like, I'm kind of crying in my beer, not just for everybody's loss, but like that I couldn't help, that I couldn't contribute, and that I had some stories. I knew I had these stories. And I'm talking to one of my other cousins, David, and he's just like, oh, and yeah, and you remember when he did this? And he said this funny thing. And there was that Christmas where we had the like the gift challenge where we all had to make each other gifts. And we would do these Secret Santas. And it like just sparked. Like an idiot, whenever I would pull footage to use in like one of these family memory projects, it would live on another drive. It would live somewhere else. It never made its way back into just like my normal organized family photo NAS folder. And like I'm rushing around. I'm like eating up all of the data because like I'm on a metered data plan just because it's cheap. And I'm like, I don't care. I'm going to eat up all of this. And I finally find it just buried in a place that I like an idiot, never would have looked for it. And I can't pull down much because, you know, 5G connections, the 5G revolution never really happened. 5G sucks. And I'm in, you know, New Jersey and you're like, I should have great coverage here and I don't. But I finally like trickle download like one video file. And it's from a Christmas where I shot like a little video project for someone who couldn't make it. And I ended up like documenting the entire, it's a 30-minute documentary of loud East Coast New Yorkers and New Jerseyans. I don't know what the name for someone from New Jersey is. And we're all sort of a little into the holiday libations and we're all a little fluid and yelling and chanting and arguing over board games and playing video games and singing and stuff like that. And then there's Phil and he's moving around and he's talking again. And I miss him. But I finally had it so I could share that again with the family. I actually pulled up like one little bit right here, just because that's him. He was a great guy. So I don't want a soapbox on how awful I think social media is. I'm not trying to like turn this into another political piece, because I think by now y'all know, like, I think y'all know how I feel about what social media does to us. The older members of our family kind of saved the week, because they were walking around with these like binders and these notebooks with photos, these physical corporeal things that have been archived preciously in special papers and plastic sheeting and protected from the elements, and they'll live on so much longer than a stupid Facebook photo gallery or like a CD with some images on it. There are these things, and you just look through them and like the memories come rushing back. And when I say things like, it matters if you can edit video from a phone, or it matters if you really care about your photo composition, social media has trained us to make these images and these videos disposable for a momentary dopamine hit of appreciation from a community. We create content to satisfy this desire or this need for recognition. I put some work into an Instagram story and people gave it some hearts, and now I feel better about myself in this moment. And I hope that my momentary panic, well, actually it wasn't momentary, it was like week long, and I just had a block. And I couldn't get past that block until my cousin David said, oh yeah, he did that thing. He made a recipe for an emergency hot toddy for Marcus. And I'm like, I know exactly where those files are now. And I go rushing off to go dig up those photos and videos. I actually have the video of him sharing this gift with my brother, which was an emergency hot toddy kit. Because he had to make it. But again, it was like, it was unique to Phil. Because that's such a funny gag of a gift. Like, we were all making pretty much these homemade gifts, and they were wacky and silly, but he also took the time to, like, write out this, the history of the hot toddy, and the different flavors that have contributed to it, and where we think the name hot toddy might have come from. And it's this, like, really, like, in the middle of a joke, he's also incredibly considerate and insightful. So, I hope what I say doesn't just kind of bounce off of people's preconceived notions, or like, this stuff matters. Right now on your phone, you've got a photo gallery. And in that photo gallery, people are going to care later what's on it. And I'm now getting to that age where I'm probably going to be going to more funerals. And it matters where I save this stuff. I'm going to get even more obsessive compulsive about backing things up and making sure I'm not just like dumping stuff on cloud storage. And I hope, I don't know, I hope some of what I'm saying is like appreciated or resonates or something like that. We're letting these companies, for their own profit, kind of convince us that this stuff is all disposable and it doesn't matter. And right now, there's a silly photo on your phone. A completely silly, forgettable, slice of life moment. I don't know what it is. You don't know what it is. But 20 years from now, 30 years from now, it's a kind of photo that someone will look at, get that little spark of memory. And it helps. It helps a lot. So thank you for letting me take a little moment there. Phil was a really good guy. He was really passionate about organ donation. And thankfully, he was able to contribute to that. And then if anyone is so inclined, his two favorite charities to donate to. If anyone is feeling generous, you have an extra buck for the holidays, to the American Diabetes Association and to the Best Friends Pet Rescue at bestfriends.org. I'm not a particularly religious person. I'm really kind of an anti-religious person in a lot of ways. But in a very practical sense, I think there's kind of a lovely idea of the Mexican tradition of sort of spreading the memory. Like, I kind of use my podcast to plant just a little seed to Phil so that it could be remembered. And apologies that now my cousin gets to live in your brain rent-free. But if you would like to contribute to those organizations, it would mean a lot. So I'm going to take one more pause, drink some coffee. Then we got to get into some news. We got a lot of really crazy news to get through. And it's a hard transition going from something like this to like, and here's the FCC again. So I need a sec. So I'm just going to mute my mic here for just a bit and drink a little more coffee and catch my breath. All right, news block. This is where I need to come up with a soundboard clip so we can just transition over. And for those of you who appreciate the vocalizations, it's probably going to be something like a news block, whoosh, something like that. And we'll figure out what that looks like, and I'll eventually be able to hit a button on it. Right now, I did add another one, but I'm holding it for a special occasion. Of something like that's painfully cringe or silly or sad that we can kind of poke a little fun at. It's a very particular flavor of soundboard sound effect, and I don't even think we're going to get to it here in this podcast. But all of the links, the show notes, I had a little housekeeping. I got a couple videos out last week, and honestly, I care, but not really. I hope you'll check out the show page on somegadgetguy.com just to make sure that you're following up with all of these stories and some of the stuff that I've put out recently on the blog, on the Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy, and then also on my YouTube channel. So, want to jump in. If there's any kind of political or FCC news, I like to lead off with that, especially when it comes from my tech news man crush, one Mr. John Brodkin over at Ars Technica. And so if I forgot to check my screen share. Well, let's see. Yeah, no, that works. Okay, Ars Technica, internet providers say the FCC should not investigate broadband prices. ISPs say anti-discrimination rules should cover only deployment, not prices. And I don't know how y'all feel about the way that ISPs conduct themselves, but I feel like that's probably kind of shady. From the article, internet service providers and their lobby groups are fighting a U.S. plan to prohibit discrimination in access to broadband services. In particular, ISPs want the FCC to drop the plan's proposal to require that prices charged to consumers be non-discriminatory. I really want that to stand out. ISPs want the Federal Communications Commission to drop the plan's proposal to require that prices charged to consumers be non-discriminatory. Now, I don't know what that sounds like to you, but it kind of sounds like to me that what they're saying is we want to be able to charge discriminatory prices. So if a massive billion-dollar corporation in charge of the ins and outs of all of our communications on the internet, who, by the way, if you remember that FTC a report that came out a couple years ago, that they also siphon off all of your user behavior data and sell that off to brokers. So they're making money on you using the internet while they're charging you to use the internet, and they charge the people who send out content to use the internet. So they're triple dipping, and they still are lobbying the FCC to say, oh, but don't look at our pricing, discriminatory pricing, that you don't need to bother. Don't waste your time looking into all that. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but the second a massive corporation says you should not investigate our pricing, I feel like that should be one of the most immediate things that we do, is start an investigation into how they charge their consumers for products. So, yeah. Or JGJ. I mean, this is already bad enough, too. When ISPs refuse to provide symmetrical up-down, you lost me there, boss. We're still dealing. I wrote a letter. I hope other people contributed to the feedback. The FCC was asking for recommendations on the future definition of high-speed broadband. And I think that, unfortunately, they're still going to say 100 down, 20 up, which is not high speed. That is not competitive in a 21st century economy, in a 21st century market. It does not keep pace with the rest of the world. Symmetrical 50-50 would be much better for us to really contribute to the economy online. Ghost Starscream, no, Ars Technica is not defending the ISPs. Don't do that. John Brodkin would never. Or JGJ, what about contract practices from the ISPs? Sure would be nice if we had some information on that. You're not wrong there. So this article breaks down, again, one of the reasons why I point out these authors on sites like Ars Technica. I'm not just blindly saying read everything on Ars Technica, but I make a point out of making that joke, my man crush, John Brodkin. This is not a crazy difficult story to get around the ins and outs. And when it's laid out like this, takes us back to 2021, Congress required the FCC to issue rules preventing digital discrimination of access based on income level, race, ethnicity, color, religion, or national origin within 2 years. So the FCC gave ISPs 2 years just to not screw some customers more than others. And now they're still fighting it. The lobbying groups of these ISPs are still fighting it. And so there's an entire block talking about the different reactions from the ISPs, the U.S. Telecom Industry Group, the Wireless Industry Trade Group, the CTIA, all of the responses to that, and then some of the legal definitions of what we consider discrimination in the telecommunications space. And thankfully, the FCC chair, Jessica Rosenworcel, is defending pricing rules. So at least now that we're free of the Ajit Pai era of the FCC, something as simple as saying like, hey, you can't charge black people more just because. And like, think about the legal limit of proving that that's what they're doing. Think about the inordinate challenge it would be to go into a courtroom against Comcast and say, hey, we think you're ripping off Hispanics or Latinos. And being able to dig up the evidence to support that more than just some nebulous guidelines. Because Comcast could always come back and say, oh, no, it's these challenges and rolling out infrastructure in these low-income neighborhoods and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, well, yeah, then what about the people in the more affluent areas that are also Latino that you're charging more? Oh, but you can't prove that that's discrimination. You don't have an email from our CEO that says, I hate Mexicans. Ma-ha! Not discriminatory. That's the incredible challenge that you would actually have to defend in a court of law. It is not a one from, like, the FCC could just roll into a town and say, oh, nope, that's not fair, and levy out fines. Anyone who's trying to make it sound like the FCC is overstepping their authority by instituting this set of rules, please understand that they are a woefully underfunded commission that would then have to see egregious harm, egregious misdeeds from a massive corporation before they'd be able to act on it. This is really just like the token effort of saying, hey, we know you're going to be scummy, but be scummy equally to all people. The ISPs are fighting that hard. And guess who else is also fighting it hard? The article also does a really good job of summing up the conservative responses from the GOP as it pertains to how these rules are going to be put into effect. So again, it's not a both sides kind of issue. I think anyone, liberal or conservative, would probably appreciate fair market practices being enforced by a soft touch reactionary regulatory commission. And yet, the people elected to represent certain communities are very aggressively fighting against this kind of rule set. And it must be nice. If you're a multi-billion dollar corporation like a Comcast, how easy it must be to curry some favor with politicians with thousands of dollars of campaign contributions just so that you can get billions of dollars in revenue. So frustrating. Ghost R Scream. Oh, never mind. I heard the R's technical title wrong. Oh, no worries. Again, I feel like John Brodkin has more often than not been on the right side of his ire for some of these political situations. Dave Burns. But Juan, it's my right as a property holder to discriminate against people I don't like for a completely rational reason like skin color or place of origin. If you can't sell yourself into slavery, are you even really free? Dave is also like my hardcore wacky leftist friend, so we enjoy the snarky talk. JGJ, like what kind of distinction are we trying to make there? Are we talking populist or corporatist GOP? If the GOP went back to being cloth coats, it'd be better for the country. I mean, I'm no fan of Barry Goldwater, but at least it would be a more consistent and rational approach to defending certain business practices. I don't think the GOP has that kind of focus on what they're trying to accomplish anymore. So anyway, I don't mean to usurp the article in talking about all the ins and outs. This is a really good way to catch up on a nuanced story of how business should be conducted on the internet. And how we should be conducting business on the internet, and how other people are going to be connecting and paying for this ability to communicate on the internet. So these types of stories I really like to highlight, and I like to spend a little time on them because they're very well sourced, they're very well organized, and they take a complicated issue like how we've been examining the broadband industry, and it gives you a path that's pretty easy to get to the end of it and say, okay, maybe I don't agree with some of what Juan's prattling on about, you know, with leftist politics, but like, you could at least come out the other side better informed on how this is actually implemented and who it might be affecting. And that to me is one of the reasons why I've always enjoyed John's work on Ars Technica. Now I've got to do a quick segue here. One Mr. Fat Produce subscribed with Prime on the Twitch, subscribed for 30 months. Hey, Andrew, we're coming up on our 3-year anniversary here. Someone please tell me in the chat what is an appropriate gift for a 3-year anniversary. This fanfare's for you. Ta-da! All right, moving right along. I'm going to get a quick drink of coffee here. But who likes to play the video games? We're going to do a gadget block in the sort of second half of this podcast, but there's also been some news about developers and some of the shenanigans that we've been seeing, some of the issues that we've been seeing with people who maybe make game engines. And so that's pretty wacky. Let me get a quick drink of coffee here.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Simon says, Hypno, it's the leather anniversary. I could get Andrew something leather. Dave Burns, developers, developers, developers. Well, so the folks at Unity kind of burned down the reputation of their platform. This is coming by way of Chris Kerr over at gamedeveloper.com. Unity is reviewing its product portfolio and says layoffs are, quote, likely. Interim CEO Jim Whitehurst said interventions will, quote, likely include discontinuing certain product offerings, reducing our workforce, and reducing our office footprint. Engine maker Unity has told shareholders it will likely be making layoffs, reducing its office footprint, and discontinuing some products as part of a comprehensive portfolio assessment. Now, if you remember, Unity is a game engine, and especially if you're into mobile gaming, you've seen that logo a lot. You probably try to think past it, but it pops up and you've encountered it. It's something that you have seen. So Unity very recently tried to rug pull the developers who were already making games and had already made games under various contracts. So Unity has a whole bunch of different tiers for the organization, or if you're an individual who makes games, stuff like that. And so they tried to retroactively apply new metrics to how you would pay Unity. If you just want to make a little game for yourself, these are like free tool sets that you can very easily get into. I think it's one of the reasons why Unity really took off in the mobile space. But then as you grow, as your organization gets larger, and as you have more downloads of that, there are different metrics and thresholds, and then you start paying Unity like maybe a percentage of some kind of ad revenue, or depending on how you're doing business. But they tried to retroactively change based on the number of downloads. And they were going to change that for people who had operated under older versions of the licensing. I'm grossly oversimplifying. It was way grosser than this. But it effectively would have made almost all of these games not only not profitable, but completely unsupportable on mobile platforms. Think about, like, every single time someone gets a new phone or installs a game on a phone and a tablet, that counts towards the download and install rate, which artificially inflates the responsibility of the developer to pay Unity. And as you can imagine, people flipped out, developers freaked out, and there was a huge backlash that resulted in the current CEO stepping down. A CEO, I believe, came from EA and was responsible for a lot of like the microtransactions built into games like FIFA. Someone please correct me if I had that wrong, but I believe that was kind of the loose timeline of he did terrible things at EA, and then unsurprisingly, he tried to do terrible things at Unity. Well, Unity now has a massive problem where developers don't trust them anymore. Even though they got rid of the CEO, there's nothing to stop them from reinstituting bad policy like this. And so increasingly, game developers are looking at other platforms and tools to build games off of. I don't know if it's pronounced Godot, because I'm a theater nerd, but there's another game engine that has spiked in popularity, and it's a slightly more open platform for people to produce on. Epic has seen a sudden surge in the companies investigating their game development tools for future production, and this is now an immediate and hard reaction coming by way of Unity. So on top of the fact that they're already talking, well, we're going to have to do some layoffs, vulgarity awaiting for Godot reference. It's a great play. I'm sorry. I, I, almost minored in dance and studied theater in college, and that it's a brilliant play. I feel like Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is a little bit more fun of also, you know, sort of examining those same sort of philosophical issues in theater, but I digress. So, the other part of this that I think is interesting, and I do believe this is going to be one of those hard transitions. While the economy is on a bubble and real estate prices are on a bubble, at some point, a stack of dominoes are going to tip. While we're focused on the human impact of this, and it sucks that developers at Unity are going to be losing their jobs, one of the other major announcements is reevaluating their real estate. And that has got to be terrifying to all of the people that have built their wealth on the real estate market. I truly believe that one of the massive pushes in forcing employees back into offices is to keep the price of commercial real estate artificially inflated. And that's how people are sort of justifying some of these policies, is because they'll make a ton more money if these commercial real estate properties are valued higher and higher and line must go up and look at all the value that we bring to the collaborative workforce, blah, 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 even though none of it has actually been true. And a few companies taking steps to say, nah, you know what, we're going to reduce our office footprint. We're going to go. It doesn't make sense for us to have big building when all of our people can do their work wherever. IT, support costs, energy costs, electricity, managing all this stuff. You know what? We're good. When a few more companies start publicly reassessing their relationship with commercial real estate, I think it's going to get real bad real fast as the valuation on that kind of stuff plummets. It's going to get pretty ugly. And I worry that we are going to see sort of not an economy crippling, I mean, potentially an economy crippling response to real estate prices plummeting. We only ever seem to see visceral sort of government and rich people reactions when their money is affected. Like, we talk and joke about AI, right? Oh, AI. Oh, we don't care if a whole bunch of humans lose their jobs and we write terrible scripts and we draw terrible intro credits for our mediocre television shows. Oh, wait, AI can also rip off our copyright? Visceral response. Get the government involved. You can't have Mickey Mouse and Iron Man and Captain America. We own that. That's our IP. Oh, but by the way, the next scripts you see with Mickey Mouse and Captain America and Iron Man, that's all going to be written by AI because screw the poor people. Mix in big, giant building that's not worth much anymore, and this is going to get proper bad, and it's going to get ugly fast. So, take a look at your stocks and your investments. I am not qualified to offer any kind of investing advice, but I would keep an eye on the long-term sort of state of this. I was actually very surprised to see them publicly addressing shareholders with, like, yes, we're going to be cutting back on our workforce, but that means we don't need as much office space. So that's bad. Pretty great. Good times. Sorry, let me catch up with some of this, some of these comments here. Absurdist Theater is amazing. I love it. I love it. Again, just the joke of waiting for something in a play. And you're supposed to sort of be bored, and it's great. So good. Brian Glaze, you just took me back to AP literature class. I love it. Dave Burns, commercial real estate. I do not think these are safe properties to have in your investment portfolio right now, but I am not qualified to give any kind of investment advice. Simon says, Hypno, that's hilarious, but I can't read that on the show. So Dave Burns, I'm hoping, Dave says, thankfully we might convert a lot of this into housing, driving the housing prices down, which, I mean, sucks for everyone that owns more than one house. I know I'm kind of upside down in my mortgage, My house is, my little cute townhouse condo thing here has accrued incredible value since we moved in, and none of that could be real. For a little condo townhouse that we have, it is massively overvalued. And we're not looking at this as some kind of investment opportunity. We're actually in the neighborhood we want to be in, and there's this kind of lovely idea that maybe we can downsize a lot of our stuff, and then this could be the house that Lex just grows up in. And so we'll probably be in a painful position if and when the market corrects itself. But I really feel for those people that can't buy anything right now. You know, if the market flips, we can maybe potentially look at some kind of refinancing situation. That'd be ugly, and we'd have to really work against, you know, current interest rates and stuff. But we could maybe figure something like that out. I have friends that have been completely priced out of owning a home, even though they make more money than Marie and I do. And that's crippling. Like, that really hurts your brain to see, like, how could those economic factors ever sustain themselves? And you realize they can't. They absolutely can't. And so the other issue is, unfortunately, a lot of this commercial space has been built in ways where it is not easy to facilitate a transition to housing. But I think at some point we've got to rip the Band-Aid off and say, hey, there's this giant office block. It's not going to be easy, but let's turn that into condos. Let's turn that into apartments. It's going to take an entire retro refit of the space to do it. But at some point, you've got to make money on the lot of land that's sitting there. And also, how many times we've seen there's a perfectly functional office building, but the people who bought the lot, no, we need to tear it down and rebuild and start with something fresh. So you might as well look at maybe trying to improve the housing situation. It's great. It's terrible, but it's great. Ghost Star Scream. Was Unity ever that massive outside of mobile games other than Assassin's Creed and The Crew? I don't know. I'm not the gaming nerd who really does a good job of keeping up with game engines. I feel like saying, was it that massive outside of mobile games, when mobile games out-earn every other type of gaming, kind of diminishes the impact of Unity. Unity was one of the most visible and most popular engines for mobile gaming, and mobile gaming revenue eclipses AAA games, console games, PC games, often combined. So this is kind of a big deal if developers are looking to step away from Unity and even just examining their tools that they can maybe use to create a future title. Some smaller developers saying, like, we might go back and rebuild one of our older titles just to see if we can do it. And someone produced, like, I think it was on Godot. I'm almost certain that's not how you're supposed to. Is it Godot or Godot or Godot? I don't know. Like, I can't remember who did it, but they did sort of like a beta test. Like, they put out a free game built on this other engine, and they were like, yeah, this works. It's not as polished. It's not as pretty. There isn't as much support for it, but we could make this work. We could absolutely rebuild some older titles on this. So yeah, it's a pretty bad look for them. Go Start Scream. I'm trying not to do that. He says, imagine how much worse the housing market when your kid gets your age. I want to do that. I'd like to maybe help make things better. Unfortunately, I can't see a way through that until there's some other type of massive economic collapse where bankers actually go to jail. Right? Sam Bankman-Fried. Last week we talked about Sam Bankman-Fried. He defrauded customers. He inappropriately used funds in a crypto exchange to gamble with other people's money. Absolutely. He's probably going to look at a lifetime sentence in jail for white-collar crime. This is an unprecedented legal arrangement. And the reason it's unprecedented and we've never seen anything like it is because no bankers went to jail after the 2007-2008 housing market collapse. So great. We got Sam Bankman-Fried. Awesome. We need to go after other bankers just as hard. And until that happens, basically our entire economy is on a broken eggshell. And it's cracking, and when it crumbles, it's going to get real bad. But if we don't discourage other people doing dumb things with our money, then it's going to keep happening until enough people are desperate that something catastrophic happens. And I don't want that to happen. I would really like for us to fix those problems before total catastrophe. But it seems that that's where all the rich people are kind of wanting to go. All of the policies instituted by lawmakers supporting billionaires is kind of leading us in a direction of complete and total unsustainable chaos. And I'd rather not see that happen. Yeah, JGJ. I mean, again, I feel like this is not a liberal or a conservative stance. I feel like this is a rational stance. He says we should not have bailed out the banks and big three automakers, saving the free market by abandoning the free market. My butt, George Bush Hoover. I can't, no lie detected. If public funds went into any industry, we should own it. That's it. You're done. And all of these like executive packages and stock buybacks. No. We put money into it. Same reason why I get all pissy about the internet. At some point, it should just be ours. CNBC. So I caught this story first on CNBC, but my browser keeps like wigging out. I might need to. All right, I'm gonna screen share now. But every time I've tried to like move around on the page, it just blanks the page out. So I'm just gonna. Oh, did it again. Okay, no, I can't. So we don't have to spend a lot of time on this because I just ranted and railed about other businesses having issues. Please pardon the typing there. Let me just get to my news. Oh, maybe CBS will work better. It's not even CBS. It's the Microsoft scraping of a CBS article. Just another one to kind of keep on the radar. It's become something of a guilty pleasure looking through the chain of hype as we see the boom bust fall of fads and trends. Very few of the things that get lit up in the consumer space especially ever seem to sustain. I think that's why the smartphone has been such a unique example of a product that went global in a big way and changed our relationship with computing and communications and all this other stuff. I also really, I on one of my flights out to Newark, I watched the BlackBerry movie. And in a very sort of nostalgic kind of way, it's sort of like the Tetris film in that way for old cusp Gen Xers like me. It really brought me back to that, like, oh, there was this explosive excitement about portable communications and data-driven devices, and this is amazing. And that's singular. That's a very unique kind of situation. But, you know, I've got a 3D printer over here. I can go back to documentaries like 10 years ago about the revolution of 3D printing. Never happened. We can look at cryptocurrencies. Not really the big, exciting, hot thing. Sure, you can kind of put some valuation on it, but yeah, whatever. Time and time and time again, we're looking for sort of this next big thing, and it's not going to be NFTs, and I don't think it's going to be AI, especially AI in this like language learning model, generative AI kind of thing. That's not a product that is going to fundamentally change our relationship with tech, data, and the world around us. Sorry, really long ramp up to a very short story here. If anyone remembers the remote business leasing real estate fad of WeWork, well, WeWork has declared bankruptcy. And I've never, ever completely fully understood what WeWork's long-term business model was supposed to be. I don't think I have a byline on this article, but it was from, Christopher Brooks, and with contributions from AP, from other AP reporters. But so I guess it was supposed to be sort of like Airbnb for office space or something. And not only was it already having issues before the pandemic, But after, you know, during the pandemic, there was no point in utilizing services like WeWork, and the company really didn't have any other kinds of fallback strategies or positions. So the idea of leasing office space to then co-lease, yeah, probably wasn't ever going to be a sustainable thing. But at one point, this was like an incredible valuation. I think it hit as much as a $50 billion valuation. And it's pretty much dead. It's pretty much gone. Okay, so Dave, I appreciate this. So Dave says, WeWork would actually be great for me now if I wanted to like work somewhere, not my living room. And I appreciate that. I think from it in a singular experience, there's a little co-op space down in Santa Monica. But basically, I didn't see anything unique about WeWork's business model that couldn't have been replicated in a very easy way from other smaller businesses with lower overhead, basically just operating like an office staff, right? Like they do the cleanup, you pay for your cubicle or your workspace, or if you have the money for an enclosed office, and you go. The fact that you needed the overhead and the infrastructure of a massive, massive corporation, $50 billion market cap at one point. I think they hit huge money from, this is from the article on CBS, SoftBank, Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, and other blue chip investors. That to me is the big warning sign. Because you know what you could also do, depending on what kind of work you do, you could also just go to your local library, put on some headphones and get some work done and not have to worry about like renting something. If you want to get real fancy, a lot of your local libraries will also have office and meeting rooms that you can book time in, and it doesn't cost you a dime. You can get it for free. There are four medium-sized meeting rooms in the local library that we take Lex to. I keep thinking, like, I might want to just start, like, doing interviews and stuff there. Like, hey, just meet me at this library and we can jump in. I can clip a little mic onto you. We can record all this audio and it'd be great. It'd be so much more professional than having you come to this gadget lab that's filled with toys and two people can barely sit in it. One of them has this beautiful window view. So I think, like, if you ever see that kind of fire up, know that I did not spend a nickel on setting up that location. So again, in my wacky far left wing platform for this week's show, support your local libraries because they can be infrastructure and resources that you didn't even know you had. Dave Burns, Juan, you're acting like I haven't made this exact argument to several people when I had to do a business treatment of WeWork in my business classes. Like, I'm not saying anything radical, Dave. I know you've made some arguments like that. What I'm saying is, like, the whole notion of, like, public meeting spaces and public, like, just how far we've gone down late-stage capitalism, that it's such a crazy or unique idea that there is a place you can go that does not demand any kind of financial interaction take place. That you can just go and sit and you're not expected to buy things or own things or rent things in the process of occupying that space. And as I get older and I get wackier and more left-wing liberal, more and more appreciation for things like libraries. It's like how cost-effective buses and trams and public transportation can be. And Silicon Valley keeps trying to find ways to usurp the bus. And it's just funny. Every time you tell that story, I remember when the Uber TV show that just came to Netflix, I think it was originally on Showtime. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And I don't know what the tone is supposed to be, if the founder is supposed to kind of be a sympathetic character, if he's kind of the villain of the piece. I don't really feel it sticks the message. Like, what message were they trying to tell? But the entire time you're watching this, you're like, yeah, there was an infrastructure of cabs. And Uber did sort of change up our relationship with hailing a cab. Great. Totally get it. But along that entire time, the show itself sort of tries to ignore the other avenues of moving people around a city and what would really be better for a city infrastructure, like buses and subways. And the more you invest in that and make a city walkable, the better it is for all the businesses out there. You can fit so many more people in a downtown space if you can eliminate the need for tons of area to be spent on parking cars. It's better for the economy. You have like a parking high rise. Well, those could all be businesses or housing or some other use of that space. So, WeWork never made any sense to me. I'm not going to miss it, and support your local library. Oh, vulgarity. You want to talk about frictionless? That was a big phrase in the Uber TV show. I'm making this frictionless. You get into this car and then you get out and you didn't have to like hand the money to the driver because I'm such a visionary. Vulgarity. I just got my library card. The lack of transactional stress in the library is a breath of fresh air. Yeah, it is. So great. You walk up to a counter and a kindly old lady like scans a bunch of books and then you just walk out. And that's it. And then they just say, I don't know, bring them back. Like if you want to say, that's frictionless. I love it. All right, so we've got a pair of Apple stories here. We've been talking about things like someone else on the Discord, I am so sorry, I completely spaced who sent me an additional link. We were talking last week about how people can build these little iPhone jammers. Apple is real bad at Bluetooth, okay? This is not a controversial statement, and for a company that spends as much time, money, and effort trying to promote the idea of privacy and security, Apple is really bad at Bluetooth, and that they're building proprietary communications systems on top of Bluetooth and not contributing as much to the Bluetooth SIG, like AirShare, whatever, and tap and share style interactions are built on NFC and built on Bluetooth, and then other protocols kind of kick over from there. If Apple had actually contributed more to the Bluetooth SIG and built these into the standard of Bluetooth, they would probably be a little more secure. But we saw last week, people are building these little flippers that constantly ping other phones pretending to be an Apple TV, and it can not only bombard the phone with enough notifications that the user can't really use the phone, it'll eventually crash the iPhone. It's a denial of service attack using this cute little tinker tool, the flipper. This exploit that I'm going to share this article with from Bleeping Computer, I don't believe is as serious in impact, but it's another one where if you have any kind of Apple device, you should really consider your relationship with like, I just leave my Bluetooth on so that I can easily connect and pair with things. It's just so convenient. So let me get this right here. From Bill Tulis over at Bleeping Computer, Apple Find My Network can be abused to steal keylogged passwords. The Find My Network and application is designed to help users locate lost or misplaced Apple devices, including iPhones, iPads, Macs, Apple Watches, AirPods, and Apple Tags. The service relies on GPS and Bluetooth data crowdsourced from millions of Apple devices worldwide to find devices reported as lost or stolen, even if they're offline. Lost devices send Bluetooth signals in a constant loop detected by nearby Apple devices, which then anonymously relay their location to the owner through the Find My Network. The potential to abuse Find My to transmit arbitrary data besides just device location was first discovered by positive security researchers Fabian Braulein and his team over 2 years ago, but apparently Apple addressed this problem. The analysts have even published their implementation on GitHub called SendMy, which others can leverage for uploading arbitrary data onto Apple's Find My Network and retrieving it from any internet device anywhere in the world. So there are other things happening in this Find My relationship, and you can get keyloggers. So a keylogger doesn't have to use an AirTag or an officially supported chip, as Apple devices are tuned to respond to any Bluetooth message. if the message is appropriately formatted. The receiving Apple device will create a location report and upload it to the Find My Network. I cannot stress enough. When I started talking about AirTags and saying, hey, this is really kind of a privacy nightmare. This is kind of a major problem with security. I was talking about that in a very practical sense. You stick an AirTag onto someone's car, and if they have an Android phone, you can track them and they'll never know. And it took Google coming up with a patch for Android to start scanning for location trackers in your vicinity and seeing if there's any kind of pattern. Apple could have worked with the Bluetooth SIG on the standard of Bluetooth 5.3. There is a component in Bluetooth for tracking warehouse content. You're starting to see, like, when you ship things from FedEx or DHL or UPS, occasionally we're starting to see these, like, location trackers. That is built on the Bluetooth warehouse inventory component, a standardized set of Bluetooth's components. AirTags are built on a proprietary Apple system that Apple has not properly safeguarded. So now, if you're on an older iPhone or an Android phone, you have to hope that these other solutions and these other apps are going to notice when a device is tracking you. Because it's also stupid simple to, like, drill out the speaker on an AirTag. So if you're on an older iPhone, you say, hey, make it chirp. Make a noise from the AirTag. Someone can disable that literally in the hardware. You don't have to have any special, like, hacking ability. You just break the speaker. Done. But apparently, it's even dumber than that. Because this is Apple's implementation of it, they have not safeguarded what quantities of data start getting exchanged over Bluetooth. So, this is still, to me, one of those slightly more targeted attacks. Someone has to have a victim in mind, not just, I can walk around blindly broadcasting all of this and get information back from a victim in a simple singular transaction. Please read through this whole article. Bleeping Computer has a whole breakdown on the actual implementation of this security threat, this security risk. But this is another example of, this is all marketing. It's all Apple media hype. This relationship in interacting with other devices around this network cannot be safeguarded to the degree that Apple advertises their products are able to do. And it's another opportunity to point out that we are on hold with Google's tracker network until Apple decides that they can update the iPhone to better respond to Google or Android-based trackers. We got the announcement that Google's Find My Phone service was going to expand for little key trackers, and then other devices like Bluetooth headphones could also be added to this with future updates to some of our audio components and other devices too. But that was back in May. In June, it was announced in May they would expand the tracker network. In June, I put in orders for a Chipolo and a Pebble Bee tracker tile. The tile network is still on hold. So if you have, like, little tile trackers, the Android compatible versions of the tile trackers are also on hold. And then in July, I got emails from all those companies saying, we've got your pre-order. They'll ship whenever Google puts this in play, but all of these orders are on hold. And the thing that's holding up Android's tracker network is Apple. So Apple gets to profit on AirTags as the only de facto solution in tracking devices. An Android tracker network would be better in most places in the world, just for how many more Android devices would be able to participate. In some markets, it's like 4-1. So you want accuracy in your tracker network. It's kind of a better way to do it with more devices. So we're just waiting. Supposedly, like, maybe by the end of the year, Apple might finally figure out how to make the iPhone more secure against trackers. But I kind of doubt it, because they can't even secure their own network on AirTags. What are they going to do when Android tracking devices are out in the wild? Apple is really bad at this. So just some fun food for thought. If you've got any family or friends, it's another one to kind of keep an eye on. You can explain to them, like, hey, if your iPhone starts freaking out and then reboots itself, it's probably because someone attacked you over Bluetooth. Hey, if you're starting to get these weird, like, pop-up Apple device notifications or AirTag notifications, it's probably because someone's trying to attack your phone. And it's a very easy vector of attack because Apple cannot secure this, apparently. This is years of ongoing security threats and privacy issues. And it doesn't really... It seems to have kind of held steady or gotten worse, depending on what application or what kind of threat that we're looking at. Aditya Anil, I knew it. All I'm hearing is broke person privacy talk. Sorry, Juan. Hashtag it just works. Ghost Starscream, at the end of the year? You're very optimistic, Juan. That's not my assessment. Google and Apple worked out some type of strategy, because Google's already implemented this. You can go into your security settings on a newer Android phone and you can find tracker alerts. It's just a part of Android. You did not have to wait for proper big heavy OTAs from most of the phone manufacturers out there. I think it was a Google Play Services update. A Google Play Services update that I think arrived with Android 13. So it's probably not going to be on older, like, Android 11 devices just yet. Someone please correct me, because I have not actually looked. I might be talking out my rear. But the relationship between Google and Apple in trying to fix this situation, their estimate was Apple is going to roll out an update for iOS, and some are saying it might happen by the end of the year. But the phrasing was like, it could happen at any time. Apple could get ahead of this. They could deliver all this. We're just waiting for them. Apple's real good at updating their phones, right? But no, increasingly, it's like Apple's going to wait until the last possible minute before they face, like, actual regulatory scrutiny. You can submit a claim to the FTC. I did. Let's see. I had the FTC letter. Oh no, that was the wrong FTC letter. I'm not sure if I have it here on my desktop still. But yeah, I submitted an anti-competition claim to the FTC because there's been no feedback from Apple as to when this might happen. I don't expect them to roll it out, just like have it ready to go. I expect them to give us a timeline, because they are holding up entire industries and they're making our products less secure. They're also making iPhone less secure because they don't have the same kind of protections for tracker alerts that we have. So this is bad for everybody, but Apple still gets to make money on it. So everyone's just sort of like, okay, well, we'll just, you know, Apple will get it done whenever they want to get it done. It's pretty great, I guess. Okay, bye.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hello, my name is Martin, and I run the Tech Altar YouTube channel. I talk about tech, obviously, but instead of focusing purely on the devices themselves, I mostly analyze the companies, their business and marketing strategies, as well as the industry trends that shape the gadgets we all love. I studied business, I worked for a couple of tech companies like Oppo in China, for example, and I'm building my own tech startup on the side right now, so I really like talking about these topics. And if you enjoy zooming out and trying to see the bigger picture as well, you can find me by searching for Tech Altar, that's Altar, on YouTube, and you can also come say hi to me on Twitter as well. Thanks, Juan.
So yeah, as much as we might share in some of that ire, write a letter to the FTC. Go to ftc.gov. There is an easy place to just fill out a request for an examination of a consumer product. And you can point to this specifically and say, hey, this is a palpable consumer harm. We are being denied competition because of Apple's malfeasance, their inability to secure their own network, and they're holding the rest of these market players hostage. I mean, this is pretty clear. Dave Burns, it just works. Doesn't do much else, though. It just works. All right, so before we move on to this next story here with Apple, and again, I keep saying we don't need to spend a lot of time on these, and this one I promise I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. we got to send a shout-out. Gary the Fireman gifted a Tier 1 sub to Aditya Anil and to Mr. Gormlord. Gary has gifted 260 gift subs in the channel. I cannot thank you enough. You've been incredibly generous, and you've just been supporting me along the way for years of doing this podcast. And Gary, you're a real one, and I really appreciate it. So this fanfare of glory, by way of one Mr. Barry Johnson, coming your way. Ba-ba. Oh, maybe that's what I need at the end of that, is like one extra little timpani, boom, just to end it with a punch, with a pow. Thank you so much, Gary. I really appreciate it. And again, it's these kinds of, it's this kind of support and the subscriptions and the sharing. It really does help keep a podcast running from week to week. So, one other just quick, this is one to keep on our radar, because I'm not sure what the ramifications of something like this might be, because I don't think it's going to be a big deal legally, but I think it's something consumers should be a little irritated by. Not a doom and gloom, oh, I think Apple get wrecked. But our relationship with commerce, how we buy and sell products, it's not a good look. So this is coming by way of 9to5Mac, written up by Chance Miller. Amazon gives Apple massive preferential treatment in secret deal, report claims. From the article, the deal between Apple and Amazon has faced quite a bit of regulatory pushback over the past several years. The two companies are also battling a price-fixing lawsuit that alleges they colluded to raise iPhone and iPad prices. As detailed by today's report, the agreement between Apple and Amazon includes a carve-out that reduces the number of ads and recommendations that appear on product pages for Apple devices. While Amazon product pages are generally full of ads, sponsored results, and recommendations, Apple's product pages show only one banner ad at the very bottom of the page. Then the article goes on to explain some of the other relationships and this, how closely tied these two companies have become in this retail space, to the detriment of maybe Apple resellers or refurbs or things like that. Apple has their own refurb plan. Other companies that would refurbish Apple products seem to have been pulled way down in the sort of search and visibility. So, I mean, this is one part an Apple problem. Apple has to have an active relationship with Amazon to sort of facilitate this kind of relationship. But this is really, in my opinion, a more damning look, yet again, at how terrible Amazon's market practices have become in controlling sort of consumer spending. And it's not enough to say that, well, Walmart and Target still exist, so Amazon is competition. Their practices in trying to monopolize a specific chunk of online retail has resulted in some really terrible business practices. And I believe it's one of those companies, like when we hear politicians like Elizabeth Warren talk about breaking up big tech, Amazon has to be one of the first companies that we really approach for that kind of separation. It's like Amazon and Google. It's not that you destroy the company, it's that you break them into smaller pieces that each have their own executives and boards. And you look at, if you have Amazon Basics and they sell products, then you also have Amazon Web Services, who can point more readily to the Amazon Basics. Then you have Amazon Ads and Revenue that get data from all of the web traffic and behavior traffic so that they can better sell Amazon Basics hardware. Then, I mean, you can kind of keep going down the row. And then when someone joins Amazon as a retail entity, if their business gets too popular, Amazon can then look at their business and say, oh, but we can copy it. And we have all of their data. We know all of their customer relationships. And we can point other people directly back to our own products and services and cut someone else out of that. All of those need to be completely separate, completely firewalled institutions. And right now we know that Amazon is gaming the entire process for their own benefit. That is an anti-consumer, anti-competition place to be. But our laws are so antiquated that someone can go into a courtroom and say, oh, but if someone doesn't want to do business with Amazon, they can go to Target. And that's not actual competition. That is the illusion of competition in a very legal sense, and you can support that argument with lawyers. But we know, as people on the ground, that's not really how all of this should work. And I completely appreciate the irony of making these kinds of, you know, radical statements about Amazon while I'm streaming this on Twitch. And celebrating people who are gifting me subs on Twitch. Please keep supporting the podcast. I like Twitch. I like streaming on Twitch better than I like streaming on YouTube. But Massive Corporation, oh no. Got another just sort of quick story here. We're 10:16. We're doing okay. I actually have to kind of close out this podcast close to 2 hours. I can go a little over. But who is also worried about Google killing Fitbit? Do we think that this is going to end up being another killed by Google situation? I'm very anxious about this. My mom is a hardcore Fitbit user. She was thinking about maybe getting a Pixel Watch, and then we said, yeah, I got to charge it like twice a day. And she was like, nope. And so she's stuck with a Fitbit. Google is pulling Fitbit from loads of markets. Article updated. Even more markets exited. This is written up by Hadley Simons over at Android Authority. So let me see. An update as of November 9, when we published this initially, we found 16 markets in which Fitbit would no longer sell its products. Shortly thereafter, 9to5 Google found a separate support page that mentioned the company moved out of even more, including Mexico and all Latin American countries. This means Fitbit has recently removed itself from 29 countries, which is more than half of its previous markets. As of now, Fitbit is only active in 23 companies. Google pulled Fitbit from over half of the companies that they would distribute to. And it seems like the companies that they're focusing, the countries that they're focused on are the countries where they have a more direct retail relationship to sell Pixels. This is the dumbest strategy. Again, Google as a trillion-dollar company, they had distribution deals in place that they could piggyback on their relationship with Fitbit to send products to these other countries, these 29 other countries. That could have been the tip of the spear, the little bit of wedge so that you could get in, you could understand the regulatory process, the approvals process, and then you could maybe start offering more of the Google products in those markets and regions too. But that's a long-term business strategy, right? That costs money over a longer period of time. It's hard. Getting through regulatory agencies is difficult. We saw how much the Pixel 4 got hurt because of that like hand gesture radar, LiDAR thing, camera on the front, and Google massively backpedaled from incorporating that kind of tech into future phones because it was hard getting through the proper regulations, getting through the proper approvals. But they had an in with Fitbit, and then they pulled it. And so now in 29 more countries, there is not going to be a Fitbit presence, which means there's even more of a reduced Google presence. And what are the people in those countries going to do? Are they going to try and like import a Fitbit? No. They're going to look at an Apple Watch. They're going to look at a Garmin. They're going to look at an Amazfit or a Tick Watch or a Xiaomi fitness band. I've got one right here. This is a baller little fitness band, and it's inexpensive, and it gets great battery life, and it works really well with numerous apps and services to track your health, and I don't see anyone pining for Fitbit after a year of this kind of strategy. So then when Fitbit tries to come back, it is essentially in 29 countries, Fitbit was killed by Google. They're just dead. They're just gone. It's over. And you're not going to win them back without a massive reinvestment in getting consumers back on that train. It will take years of advertising and losing in that space again to convince consumers that you're really going to be there for them and that you'll stick around. The second you pull the plug, you're dead. If this were a market where there were only a couple other fitness bands and they were sort of lower tier or lower profile than Fitbit, maybe you could make some kind of return. Just say, hey, we worked on our product portfolio, really wanted to offer the best services, work with your local regional government, and now we're going to be back with a vengeance. But that's not the case. In 1 year, all of those consumers are going to start thinking like, well, but do I want to keep doing business with Fitbit? Maybe I just need to move on. I have an older watch. I'm going to get an Apple Watch. You've lost all those consumers. And if you come back in a year, 2 years, 5 years, you're not only starting from scratch, you're starting from the negative. You're starting in the red. You've got to rebuild all the trust that you had when you left. Because now all those people, they don't think that you're going to stick it out. So I could not have been more disappointed in Google doing this. You spend the money, even though it's a massive loss. I have to believe it is a significant loss. Sure. But if you don't keep the Fitbit brand alive, then what are you doing? Because you're not going to roll people over to Pixel immediately. I'm wearing the Pixel Watch 2, solid watch. You know what's better? Having 3 or 4 days of battery life with intense health tracking capabilities. If that's what you're really selling me on for a watch, the Fitbits were better. If you want to sell me on all of the smart little fancy smartwatch, smartphone things that you can do with it, then yeah. It's just simply the ability to talk at my watch, which is locked right now, to talk at my watch and have it type out my reply. Great. I don't feel like you're really winning that war with consumers right now. You're not really winning the hearts and minds. So if you're in the United States, Canada, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Ireland, Spain, Finland, Greece, France, Italy, Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, the UK, Australia, India, Japan, New Zealand, Singapore, and Taiwan, you can still buy a Fitbit. Congratulations. Until Google decides to pull out of your country too. Steve Pogue, I wonder, man. I'm telling you, there's some corporate espionage happening here. There's someone at Google who's like, yes, how can I make the smartwatches fail? I used to work at Samsung. And ER1980, I completely agree with you. I think this is kind of the long-term strategy. I think the Fitbit name is going to disappear over time and replaced by Pixel. They are pulling, in my opinion, from markets. They don't have full control in terms of supply chain and support under the Google brand. I completely agree with you. But if you want to get people in other regions of the world to keep buying Pixel watches or Google products, you use Fitbit as the entry point. You get people, you keep people using your Fitbit stuff, and then you start layering in a bit more of the Googly stuff, and then you find those avenues. You've got the experience of getting through selling a product in that region, and then you can use that to help facilitate a relationship to bring a phone over there too. Or earbuds. Start with all the accessories. Could be great. But no. So they're going to kill it. I think this is going to go very poorly for Google in the long term, but it's going to look great to shareholders for like a fiscal quarter. Go Starscream. So I think you caught what I was trying to say there. The people that are thinking about getting an Apple Watch are going to have to get an iPhone as well, if they didn't already have an iPhone at the moment, because Fitbits work with iPhones. This is a win-win for Apple, unfortunately. Yeah. Because it creates a vacuum of products. And who's going to fill that space most aggressively? In most of these regions, Apple and Xiaomi. So, I mean, you can hope if you're Google and you're really looking at like the future outlook of Android, you can hope that people are going to pick up Xiaomi fitness bands. But we know the whole ecosystem argument works really well. And if you need your watch to it just works, then you should get a phone that it just works. And so you're going to see I believe you will see a not insignificant shift in Android users switching to Apple in those countries over the next year. As soon as those products are actually gone from store shelves, I bet if we could track that kind of consumer data and products, the number of products that ship, I bet you we'd see a shift in Android to Apple adoption. So, I mean, that technically got us into the gadget block, but this is now, we can really talk about some real stuff. I kind of wanted to pull this up here. Come on. Ah, there we go. So last week, we got to talk a little bit about the new MediaTek Dimensity 9300. And like I said at the beginning of this podcast, we're seeing an acceleration in when devices are launched. So we usually used to look for like Samsung launching a new Galaxy sometime around MWC, and that would kick off that year's generation of products. But other companies like Xiaomi and Oppo and Vivo have been sort of front-loading their product launches before Samsung. And there was like kind of a window there where it was like, oh, they're going to launch just before MWC. Oh, they're going to launch in January. They're going to launch just before CES. And now it's like they're going to launch in November. So the 2024 phones are launching months earlier in 2023. And so we already saw the Xiaomi 14 is out. It is killing me not to import that device. And Vivo is also following suit. And this one is really gutting me, because Vivo was a company that sparked a huge excitement for me when it came to smartphone photography from the X70 Pro Plus and the X80 and the X90 series. Now we're seeing the official reveal, the official showing of the Vivo X100 and the X100 Pro. Both of them are launching with that new MediaTek Dimensity 9300. This looks like a great follow-up device to what the X90 Pro was. I still was a little disappointed that internationally we never got the X90 Pro Plus. So the X90 Pro had the Dimensity 9200. The X90 Pro Plus had the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. But really for me, it was the camera sensors. You had the proper quartet of camera sensors on the Pro Plus. We don't have, and someone please correct me if I'm wrong right now, I don't believe we have a proper accounting of what the X100 Pro Plus is going to be. But I'm pretty confident that it's going to end up being like this year was, where that Pro Plus is going to be a Chinese-only release. So the X100 Pro will eventually launch internationally. The X100 Pro Plus is going to be just in China. But with all the big claims, you know, we've got MediaTek talking about a huge CPU core advantage over Qualcomm, but I think Qualcomm is probably going to be a little ahead on GPU performance, and maybe we're going to have to see how they fight over AI. I'll be curious to see if the division is MediaTek for the X100 and X100 Pro and Qualcomm for the X100 Pro Plus, because I don't think the performance difference is going to be that significant. And in many ways, the 9300 is probably going to be better than the 8 Gen 3 for a lot of applications out there, especially because Vivo is still talking about stapling on their coprocessor. So we're going to get that V3, which is what helps improve all of your photography. Really, it radically shortens the processing time on HDR and on low light, on night mode performance. And it also helps drive the screen. So it reduces power consumption from the SoC in facilitating the high frame rate on your smartphone's display. That V3 is one of the most impressive things that I've seen in a phone in years. And it really is a shame that people aren't more aware of what these little sort of add-on or bolt-on coprocessors can really achieve. I'm playing with the OnePlus Open, and it desperately needs an update for the camera. I'm not doing my camera review on the OnePlus Open until this is addressed in some way. But if it's really dark conditions around you, not even really dark, if it's just sort of city dark, you've got some like street lamps and lights and stuff, but you know, you don't have a ton of illumination, a night mode shot from that incredible camera sensor, the camera sensor that theoretically can soak up more light per second than a 1-inch type sensor, you have to hold steady for like 8 to 9 seconds. I had a Vivo X70 Pro Plus 3 generations back that would achieve not only similar, but often better night mode performance than the OnePlus Open in 2 to 3 seconds. If you really have to hold still for 9 seconds, I think my capture rate, and like, I'm pretty good at this. I don't have the steadiest hands. I am not a surgeon, but my hit rate for the OnePlus Open in darker conditions is kind of 1 out of 3, which means if I don't nail it on the first shot, I'm in for another 9 seconds. And if I don't nail it on that one, I could be standing still like an idiot for 30 seconds. If you're pointing a camera at something and you're out in public, hold still for 30 seconds and look at what kind of an idiot you look like, right? But if you want to get the shot on the OnePlus Open, it takes a really long time. So that's one of the things you can point out, like a V3 on a 1-inch sensor, 3-second burst. 1, 2, 3, done. And it is vibrantly bright. It is aggressively night into day bright. It is the most unrealistic presentation of a dark scene that you can get. And that is how impressive that camera stack is. Every time I shoot on a Vivo, I tap and then I drop the exposure slider a full stop. So they are still going to be using a 1-inch type sensor on the X100 Pro, which I think is going to be an interesting fight against the Xiaomi 14 Pro, because the Xiaomi 14 Pro is not using a 1-inch sensor. They're going to a smaller stacked sensor, but it's not going to have a variable aperture, and so we should be for an interesting debate, sort of an interesting comparison of pros and cons. But I caught this first coming by way of 91 Mobiles. Pricing, we've got models, the base model is starting at 12 gigs of RAM with 256 gig of storage. It goes all the way up to a 16 gig of RAM with 1 terabyte of storage, coming in 4 different colors, a blue, a white, an orange, and a black. And it looks like it's already starting to ship out. What's incredible to me is how aggressive Vivo has been able to fight this on pricing. So just on a whim, I pulled up Giztop, and it was everything I could do to not just put in an order, because the Vivo X100 Pro 16 gigs of RAM, 1 terabyte version of the phone is $1,100. That's a 1-inch type sensor. It's a triple camera rear setup. I wish it was the quad camera, but it's pretty good triple camera rear sensors. It's got that brighter E6 AMOLED. I think it can crank up to like 3,000 nits in a burst of brightness. 120-watt fast charging. This is just a beast of a phone that is built really well to go head-to-head against like a Galaxy Plus. It's priced to go pretty decently against a Galaxy Plus. We're sort of in between. At its most expensive configuration, we're kind of in between a Galaxy Plus and a Galaxy Ultra, but with some significant improvements. A 1-inch type sensor and 120-watt fast charging is a pretty good jump over what Samsung is doing on their middle premium Galaxy phone. So yeah, like, it says it's in stock. I can add it to the cart now. It's everything I can do to not pull the trigger on that. I really, really want to hold off. And if I get a Vivo, I would kind of appreciate going with the more international model, because then it might work a little bit better on some of my local network and stuff. But Barry, I'm right there with you, man. Barry says, my wallet is in full protest mode right now. I need Xiaomi and Vivo to calm down. Like, we're only about halfway through our holiday gift buying. I can't go spending like $3,000 on phones and stuff. It's like there's a pair of glasses I really want to get. They're only in China. I can't. I really want to get the X100 Pro. I just can't. And I still haven't finished up all of my Pixel 8 Pro and OnePlus Open. Even there's a Pixel Fold video that I have been struggling to finish. And like, man, I think I need to stop turning this stuff into videos. I just need to get this stuff out of my brain and publish it on the Patreon and then move it to somegadgetguide.com. But yeah, Gabaletta. Vivos are incredible. Gab says, the Vivo X100 Pro is looking like a monster camera device. Every manufacturer has their own unique spin. And anytime you see a techie say, oh, I mean, like a Hasselblad, whatever that means, these partnerships significantly improve the full consumer experience and the total photo output. Every single time we've seen Hasselblad, Zeiss, or Leica partner with a phone manufacturer, that phone's photography capabilities have improved significantly. And so even between the BBK brands, the Hasselblad relationship with Oppo is different than the Zeiss relationship with Vivo. And what Vivo has always tried to accomplish is the most aggressive brightness. Even in a daylight lit scene, bright California sun coming down, perfect lighting conditions, it is highlighting brightness and pulling information out of any potential shadow in a very, it's a very aggressive kind of processing, but in a very unique look. And Oppo is not doing that. Oppo is leaning into a more contrasty kind of look. I feel Vivo white balance is a little warmer. I feel Oppo white balance is a little cooler, especially when we look at like similar shots here in golden light in Southern California. So these are two brands under the BBK umbrella, and they could not be more different in actual practical application. And then we get into things like night modes where Vivos just crush. Like, if you need to shoot a photo in near total darkness and see, like, each individual leaf on a tree, you gotta have a Vivo. Because it's gonna do that without a tripod, handheld, in almost total darkness in, like, 4 seconds. You know, if you do that with an Oppo, you're gonna get a very nice, dark image, low noise, good color accuracy, but it's gonna be more reflective of the light in that moment. It is not gonna boost that color, that brightness, nearly as well or nearly as quickly as what a Vivo can do. So under the same BBK umbrella, we see massive differences in philosophy and processing and output and how the camera sensors are utilized. And then you get into Xiaomi with their Leica partnership. And just like Huawei phones of old, there's a more subtly distorted, comforting photography look that gets applied when you use something like Leica Authentic. They're trying to make it look more like old glass, old lenses on film. And I think they do a really good job of that. And when I take photos from my Xiaomi 13 Ultra, they look more like photos and less like smartphone camera shots. So again, all of these things kind of play back and forth. $1,100. I can import a base model. Let me pull this back down. The 12 gig, 256 gig of storage. So first off, I just want to point out that like Samsung, I think Vivo is getting the message. This is a premium tier phone. It's already going to be expensive no matter what they do in terms of configurations and parts and costs. So there's no point starting this phone line off at 128 gig. And we're starting to see Samsung, like, they still might make a 128 gig phone, but really, like, one of the first things they do is try and put out, like, a coupon or a trade-in that immediately moves you up to the 256 for the same price as the 128. We're starting to figure out, on a phone that you can't upgrade the storage, that 128 is garbage. But yeah, on Giztop right now, I can pull the trigger and 12 gigs of storage, 12 gigs of RAM, 256 gig of storage for $899. Shipped to my door. Oh, that doesn't include shipping costs, but the cost of the phone, $900. I mean, we're still in, that's still in Galaxy S23 territory. That's like iPhone 15 Plus territory. Maybe not 15 Pro. And you'd have some debates as to whether or not all the camera sensors match up with the iPhone, blah, 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 blah. But at $900 for 256 gig of storage, what does that cost on an iPhone? Let's see. Someone can probably find it or has memorized it even faster than I can get to it. But I am now at theapple.com, iPhone 15. We want, I just want to buy it. So I think they started $899. iPhone 15 Plus, because we want it to be fair with a bigger battery. And we'll go blue, because I did blue before. And yeah, let's just see this right here. Well, wouldn't you know it, if you go down, so here's the iPhone, you go to an iPhone 15 Plus with 128 gig of storage is $899. So if you get a Dimensity 9300 with a triple camera rear. One of the cameras is the IMX989, a 1-inch type sensor. It has 120 watt charging and twice the storage. It's going to be the same price as the base model iPhone 15 Plus. So I feel like that's pretty good because I'm also importing it from China. I'm not buying it locally. That means I'm paying a premium to get that phone here, because the importer also needs to make money on this transaction, which means it's even cheaper in China, which just kind of blows my mind. That's kind of ridiculous. So yeah, I'm very anxious. Over the next week, we're probably going to be getting a little bit more news about the silicon industry, what Qualcomm is going to be doing in this space, what MediaTek is going to be doing in this space. And now we're going to start to see, especially from the people who are more aggressively importing Chinese phones, we're going to see some X100 Pro coverage, and it looks like this thing's going to be a champ. I hope we get an international flavor of a Pro Plus, but I don't know what that's going to look like. So I want to wrap this show up. If you'll pardon me for just a couple minutes. I actually just got something come in, and I need to go jump out of the office here for just a second. This is terrible podcasting. I apologize, but I'll leave it on this little Steam Deck thing here for just a minute, and I will be right back.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
I wish someone could take over the stream. That would have been great. Talk amongst yourselves. It's coffee talk. I'll start off. Holy Roman Empire. Not holy, not Roman, not an empire. Discuss. Sorry about that. Okay, my wife is on a conference call right now, and our doorbell went off twice. Thankfully, it was our neighbor. It's not something that I thought it was going to be. Totally fine. Everything's fine. I'm trying to like catch my breath from running down the stairs and running back up quickly. I definitely need to be doing more cardio. We're going to wrap up this week's show talking about the Steam Deck. I have my original. This is like the launch week Steam Deck. This is like one of the first batches of Steam Decks that came out. I still have it in here. The really noisy fan. They fixed the fan in like a little iteration just as they were getting different parts into the Steam Deck. You know, like the buttons and the triggers feel different on mine than any later built Steam Decks. I'm kind of going to hold on to this as kind of a little bit of a museum piece. But true to their word, and this is something that I think is really exciting, Valve came out and said, we don't foresee an immediate future where a Steam Deck 2 makes sense. And Steam Deck comes out, I finally get my hands on one, and immediately there's this rush in tech reviewers to find the Steam Deck killer. There are all these boutique-y handheld PC devices that are more powerful or have beefier chipsets or a different storage configuration, and they run full Windows as if that's some kind of perk in a portable handheld space. And really, the only thing that kills the Steam Deck in this space, I would say, is the Nintendo Switch. And that's in part because of the entire infrastructure surrounding a product. What Valve did was standardize PC gaming. This is the base. Like, you don't want to go below a Steam Deck for a good PC gaming experience. I mean, especially when we're talking about mobile, gaming laptop, and handheld. But then we saw other players. Asus came out with an update, that Z1 Extreme. We saw Lenovo and their Legion brand come out with another handheld. and they all seemed to have different trade-offs. It wasn't just one-to-one, that ASUS, that ROG Ally, it's better. It's more powerful, so it's better. What we saw was it was more powerful, so you could drop the battery life even a little bit faster than on a Steam Deck. It was less consistent, so when you're really playing at like max performance settings, you would see a fluctuation in frame rate where you would maybe end up in some games, not in all games, but in a few, depending on what you liked to play, it could maybe arrive at a lower consistent frame rate than the Steam Deck. And I'd rather have, you know, a more consistent frame rate than a spike of frame rate into like the high 60s and then drop it to the 20s and then spike up to the 60s and drop it to the 20s. I've talked about that on phones. Xiaomi phones can be maddening in some games because instead of just settling into a consistent performance, it's constantly trying to find ways to spike performance and then it can't sustain that performance. So Valve comes out and says, like, it doesn't really make sense for us. We're not going to release a Steam Deck 2 in this like iterative generation of AMD APUs. The little chip that's in the Steam Deck, it's a little AMD chip. It's very similar to some of the stuff that we see in consoles. Companies say things like that, and then they change their minds, or they get a little bit more market pressure from some loud nerds or tech reviewers, or just something might change in that outlook. And then all of a sudden we see like 6 months later, there's an announcement on a Steam Deck 2. I am so excited that this new iteration on the Steam Deck is very similar to what Nintendo did. We had the Nintendo Switch, and then they released the Switch OLED. And functionally, they're very similar portable gaming handheld consoles. But one is kind of a little nicer than the other, but if you had the older one, then it's not like you were completely outclassed and you're completely off the reservation and no games are going to be made for your old LCD Switch. It's a little more subtle than that. Diehard Nintendo Switch players, sure, they might want to flip it, get the OLED, because it is the sort of newest iteration on that hardware. But if you had the older Switch, maybe you're not bothered. Maybe it's okay that you just hang out for a little bit longer until something more substantial comes around. Valve said that they weren't going to release the Steam Deck 2, and then they didn't. And what they did instead is kind of what I wish more phone manufacturers would really lean into. TK and I have been talking about phones and SoCs and CPUs and GPUs for years now. And especially in that transition from 2019 to 2021. Those 2 years, we kept getting told, this new chip is coming out. It's like 15% more powerful. It's like 20% more powerful. And if you could use it the same way as the older chip, you would see better battery life. But instead, we'd get the phone, and then we'd try to do something on it, and the phone would peak its performance, run stupid hot, and then throttle way worse than the chip that came out before it. And we got that 2 years in a row, from the 865 to the 888 to the 8 Gen 1. And if you looked at the bar graphs, if you looked at those performance per watt graphs that every company comes out with, you would see, oh, you know, here's where the 865 performance is, and if the 888 stopped at that same amount of power, it would still be like a 5% improvement, but you'd be using less power. But then our phones would never really resemble that. They would always just peak and run stupid hot, and then the performance would be worse. So, Steam Deck OLED. It's not Steam Deck 2. I almost just called it Steam Deck 2. It is not Steam Deck 2. I'm going to go back to Valve's page here. Steam Deck OLED, starting at $549, coming November 16th. And of course, immediately they're showing off. Like, OLEDs are great. Much, much better contrast, brighter colors. You know, we all know what that shift can be. Because also, I've been playing on my Steam Deck a lot with XR glasses. And the little micro OLEDs in those glasses produce a better image than the LCD that on mine, especially on my original launch Steam Deck, has very inconsistent lighting. The lighting pattern on my Steam Deck is... Oh, I'm not even showing the Steam Deck on the screen. Sorry. I'm real good at the podcasting. I could see it on my monitor. I suck. So the backlighting on my LCD Steam Deck is like bordering the bottom and the right hand side is brighter than the upper bezel and the left hand side. So I'm very interested in OLED, and at some point I might try to see if there can be a one-to-one swap in the future, because obviously this isn't going to happen right away. But if we can get an OLED for the original first generation Steam Deck, that to me would be kind of the major improvement that I personally would want to see. But there are other little improvements here that are brilliant. I love. This is exactly what they said and exactly what I want to see other companies do. So it's not just an OLED screen. They've completely redesigned the internals on the Steam Deck. This is a totally new configuration. And the AMD APU got a die shrink. So it went from a 7-nanometer chip to a 6-nanometer chip. They're improving Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and a better fan. The entire array is a little bit lighter. But they fit in a bigger battery. Then they did a die shrink on the APU, and they've improved the efficiency of all the wireless components. Valve is estimating between 30 and 50% more battery life, but they're not boasting about any performance improvements. So if you have a Steam Deck 1 like I do, that is still the baseline. Steam Deck OLED won't play games much better than Steam Deck LCD. So my Steam Deck is still kind of the minimum PC portable gaming experience that we should expect. I love it. I love it. It would be nice to grab the OLED, get the better screen, and then extend my runtime another 30%, depending on what kind of games that I'm really taxing the Steam Deck with. I think their 30% estimate is probably a little optimistic if you were trying to run I tried to stream RoboCop Rogue City from the Steam Deck. Can't handle it. It's real bad. It's real goofy bad. But for some of the other titles that have run well-ish, a more efficient chip not delivering a higher frames per second, but really maximizing that battery life. That's what I want in a portable. That's what I want in something that travels with me. That's what I want when I'm flying from LA to Newark. Right now, when I make that cross-country flight, I'm purposely picking games that I know will kind of hang for most of the flight. The beefiest I'll really go is something like Tetris Effect, where it's deceptively computationally heavy. It's Tetris, but there's lots of like particle and animation effects and stuff like that, and it's really pretty. But I'm also usually playing on XR glasses that also turn the screen off. So the whole unit, the whole Steam Deck, is actually running just a little cooler because it's not trying to blast that LCD. The LCD is off. So I'm already trying to do a few things that can kind of help with that. And that kind of an effect, like really playing a game like that, I can make it the flight from LA to Newark. It's great. I love it. If I didn't have to manage that and I had a better screen just built into the Steam Deck, I maybe wouldn't think that the XR glasses are so precious to add as an accessory to really sort of maximize my gameplay like that. But this announcement from Valve is critically exciting. I will probably not get a Steam Deck OLED, at least not right at launch, because I'm perfectly happy with the performance of my Steam Deck, and a lot of the games that are heavier lifting kind of applications, I already tend to play plugged in, and I already have that kind of solution in mind. Like if I'm on an airplane and I can plug in an adapter and I can kind of power the Steam Deck, then I don't even need to worry about battery life. It is very rare that I personally am playing my Steam Deck out in a location or out in a space where I really have zero access to power or the ability to also carry a backup power brick, a portable battery or power station or whatever we're supposed to call them now. So if you're looking at trying to get into PC gaming,
The Steam Deck experiment has done exactly what I think Valve was hoping it would do. I have to believe that the Steam Deck is sold near cost, or maybe even just on the edge of losing money per unit sold, especially with the incredible amount of support they've put out into the ecosystem. All the replacement parts, all of the specifications, all of the CAD, so that people could build their own accessories and replacement parts for the Steam Deck. That means those sales aren't going directly to Valve. And Valve had to work at putting that information out there. So that was a cost that doesn't immediately pay off. But since getting the Steam Deck, boy howdy, have I bought a lot more games than on Steam than before I had the Steam Deck. And I'm regularly going through and finding little indie titles and little shooters, and it's just been a joy. Sometimes I'm picking up bundles on Humble Bundle, but often it's the immediacy of having it in my hands going, hey, that looks like a random little shooter or Vampire Survivors clone or like just like a twin stick. You know, I just want to try it. I just want to see. It's like five bucks. I could throw $5 and it's right there. And then I'm playing it. And I am absolutely falling for that kind of like frictionless consumerism, right? I was like making fun of Uber earlier on in the podcast for using this phrase, frictionless transactions. And it worked for me on the Steam Deck. I really appreciate going frictionless on my Steam Deck to buy more games. So I really respect that this was the play. And actually they do have an image. Hold on, I'm going to screen share this just while we talk a little bit. Just like they took the back case off. And you can see, if you know what the inside of the Steam Deck looks like, because I've watched tons of those teardowns and part replacements and part swaps and stuff. This entire configuration on the inside of the Steam Deck OLED is very different than what's inside my original launch Steam Deck. Like the fan size, the battery size, everything does not look like what the inside of mine looks like. And that is critically exciting to see this kind of refinement come in the first iterative update to the Steam Deck. It blows my mind that the Steam Deck I have is a first generation product from a company that is not known for making PCs. It's shocking to me. They tried to do Steam boxes. They have one of the best original generation style VR headsets. We know this company, the controller was solid too. We know this company can make good hardware, but the entire soup to nuts experience of picking up this thing in my hands and finding a game and buying a game, installing it and playing it has been one of the best experiences I've ever had. And then it's just been wonderfully compatible with generations old games. It's not something that we have as easy on like a Nintendo Switch. The way that you encounter and play through older games on a Nintendo Switch is not as nice. It's geekier on a Steam Deck. You have to kind of maybe dig through emulators and stuff. But like the original Nintendo catalog experience on my Steam Deck is kind of better than the original Nintendo catalog experience on the Switch. And I'm that guy. I desperately want Nintendo to look at their original NES and SNES libraries and say, you know what? We can build our own emulator into this app, and then you buy Super Mario World again, or Super Mario Bros. 1, 2, and 3 for the original NES. And each one is its own little self-contained emulated ROM, but we'll sell it to you through the iTunes App Store or through Google Play for $10. And to me, that would be worth it. If I could count on that living on my Android devices, I could play all those classic Nintendo games, it would be great. But this is that thing. Valve is really good at talking about like, hey, piracy is not a problem of costs and money. It's a problem of accessibility and customer support. And every time, like, I'm a huge nerd for the classic NES game Blaster Master. I almost bought a Nintendo Switch just to play Blaster Master again. I love that old NES game. But then it came out on PC as sort of a refresh called Blaster Master Zero.
and it's almost as good as the original Nintendo version. It's enough to scratch the itch, and then I could just play it on my Steam Deck. So now, I gave Steam, I think it was $14.99 to get the entire trilogy of Blaster Master Zero games, which is half the price that I would have paid Nintendo directly if I could have gotten all of the Blaster Master games as standalone apps, like through Google Play. And they're just on my Steam Deck. They are always on my Steam Deck. I can always just revisit Blaster Master. And we don't have to worry as much with this whole silly compatibility issue of like going back to older PC games and titles and stuff like that, where like I still have a PS3 in a box in our closet just because every now and then there are a couple games on that PS3 that I like to trot out. And the only way I can really consistently play them because of that crazy processor that was built into the PS3 is to lug out an entire console and charge up some ancient controllers and play the games that way. PS3 emulation is actually starting to get pretty good. So that might change for me in the future, where maybe I don't need to pull out the PS3 anymore. But yeah, it's getting pretty crazy. Just to kind of go down a little bit of this, I wanted to show... Oh, I thought I could expand this. Oh, there it is. So yeah, here's from Valve, from Steam. They updated the APU to 6 nanometers for better efficiency, updated memory, improving latency and power management, increased thermal module thickness and performance. There's a slight screen area upgrade. The refresh rate climbs from 60 hertz to 90 hertz. The peak brightness is now 1,000 nits. The updated touchscreen polling rate to 180 hertz, that's silly when we've been talking about phones that do like 240 hertz and higher. There's a couple phones that are doing like 480 polling touchscreen responsiveness. The touchscreen interaction on the first generation Steam Deck is terrible. I just saw that BlackBerry movie, and towards the end, no spoilers, but towards the end, they start talking about their touchscreen BlackBerry, and I remember how terrible it was to kind of type on that clicky touchscreen. It's sort of like that on the Steam Deck. If you pull up the keyboard to search for something, it's like, you can't type on it. You just push one key until it sort of registers, and then you kind of move to the next key, into the next key, into the next key. Updating the sensitivity of the touchscreen on the Steam Deck OLED is a nice quality of life improvement over what we currently have on the original Steam Deck. Improvements to Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, better controls and adjustments for all of the analog sticks. I love this. They even mentioned improved bass response for an overall flatter sound profile and added support for using onboard microphone arrays simultaneously with the 3.5 millimeter headphone connector. So now we have better audio routing capabilities. We're going from a 40 watt hour battery to a 50 watt hour battery. We got a 25% improvement in the battery capacity with faster charging. So now I believe my Steam Deck original has a 45 watt charger. And so now it seems like the middle area, the 20 to 80% range on the battery, charges even faster. They also improved the cable length. So you get a charger with the Steam Deck, which we should always get chargers with our expensive gadgets. And now it's a 2.5 meter cable, which is awesome because the original Steam Deck cable, like if I have it plugged in near my bed, it doesn't really reach. It like you're kind of like gaming at an angle to get it to kind of like roll off the side of the bed and hit the little charger strip that I've got near the bed. From Wes Easton. Wes, here's what I was going to follow this up with. Wes says, give me the Steam Deck OLED you're not buying for yourself. So I'm going to buy one and send it out to Wes. I did want to get down just to the end of this here. There's a new orange power button. So I know that was very critically important to everybody. All the rest of this remains. Trackpads, grips, buttons, gyros.
micro SD card expansion, the fast suspend resume, hi-fi audio. They're looking at even more accessory support. And they've got like this image showing Nintendo controllers and Xbox controllers and the Xbox adaptive controller and audio gear and monitors. You plug it into a dock and it just becomes like a docked console, like any other, like a Nintendo Switch or like an Xbox. So getting down into pricing, the LCD is sticking around now as a low-cost option, but they got rid of that terrible 64 gigabyte model. So for $399, you can get the original LCD version with 256 gig of storage. The base model OLED starts with 512 for $549. There's a 1 terabyte OLED for $649. And then they have like a special limited edition that has a... I don't believe the Steam Deck is any different. But for $30 more, you get a different case. And it has like an exclusive startup movie and virtual keyboard themes and all the software stuff that genuinely I haven't really messed with. I have, like, from getting the Steam Deck premium version at launch, I have all these other like unique skins and startup movies, and I don't care. I genuinely don't. I just want to get in and play my games. I don't care what my keyboard looks like. That's silly. I'm not going to mess with something like that. But if you care about things like that, $30 more does get you a better case. So you can put your Steam Deck in a better case. So when it comes to the Steam Deck, I'd really gotten this and had all kinds of plans for doing tons of coverage on portables and gaming, and that kind of fell apart. I got the Steam Deck in, and then I started playing games on it, and I just really liked playing games on the Steam Deck. I did a video talking about it when it was originally announced for Newegg, and then I did another video comparing it against the Switch on... It wasn't reviews. No, it was on Slick Deals. We did a video on Slick Deals, and a lot of people didn't like what I had to say about performance comparing the Steam Deck against the Nintendo Switch, because gaming nerds are terrible and they don't understand nuance. But I never really loved the Nintendo Switch experience, and now when I pick up the Steam Deck, it fits my... I have little hobbit hands, but it fits my grown-up hobbit hands better. And to me, this is a meatier, chunkier thing to hold on to really play my games, and I like it better than picking up the Nintendo, which feels flatter and skinnier. That's more for my daughter. With her 8-year-old hands, something like the Switch or my Razer Edge, loves it. It's great. She can game like crazy. She has a harder time picking up my Steam Deck. So, I didn't dig into as much coverage because I really just enjoyed using it, and I liked playing games on it, and I kind of realized I didn't want to turn my gaming into another side hustle. So, like, last week when I had a little mini review about RoboCop Rogue City, I just felt like that was a unique thing to talk about, but I'm not really looking to constantly play games on channel, on stream, and review games and come up with new editorial places to take this. Like, I kind of need a safe place to go where I can just unwind and blow off some steam and just, like, have a good time. Increasingly, I should start reaching out to friends and starting to game online again and collaborate and play with other people. Andrew keeps, like, gifting me games. Like, hey, you should do this, and then we can play together. And I'm like, I really want to do that. But when I play, that's why I love the Steam Deck, is because I might only get, like, 15 minutes. You know, like, I've got an 8-year-old daughter, and I work from home, and I'm doing aggressive production, and I got to take, you know, like, this video's rendering, I can just pick up my Steam Deck, push the power button, be playing a game, the video finishes rendering, and then I can go and let it upload, I can game for another 20 minutes, and then I have to start making a thumbnail and writing a video description and putting in affiliate links and all of the ticky-tacky work that goes into all of this. So I just kind of sat back and said, you know, like, I guess I don't need to make this a primary conversation on the channel, but it's a fun thing to visit from time to time. It's a fun thing to visit right now because we just got exciting news about it. So I'm probably not going to buy a Steam Deck OLED. But if I do, one of the things that will also be kind of fun is, like, I still have this Steam Deck. And from time to time, Marie has picked it up. And Marie loves playing classic Nintendo games, and she loves playing Tetris. And every now and then, I can kind of get her to check out, like, an arcade racer or something like that. All the things that would play really well on a Steam Deck, it's a very easy gadget for her to pick up, to use. She doesn't have Windows on a tiny screen that's hard to control. She goes immediately into a gaming UI. She doesn't even have to launch the gaming UI. It opens up. She sees what the games are. She sees what games are installed. She can see my entire catalog of Steam games. And then she picks one and she plays it. And that's frictionless, to steal the phrase from the Uber CEO. So I have this, and it actually does look like it's going to be a solid hand-me-down for at least the next year, maybe two. I think that in the next iteration of AMD hardware, we're probably going to see some further improvements, but it might be 2 years before we look at Steam Deck OLED and then think, okay, we have the performance improvements, we've got the power improvements, and now we can take the mobile performance up to this tier while maintaining that battery life. It might not happen till 2025. But this will still be ridiculous overkill for what my wife likes to play. So it's an easy pass this down to Marie when Juan is ready to pick up the new hotness and game on that. So I've been really excited about some of the plays that we've seen. I recently put out that video on the Wizbox G. I had a review out on a slightly older AMD mini PC. And now with Steam Deck, really taking a look at like refinement over just trying to impress you with benchmark scores. That's huge. I do not care if this is technically 15% faster on paper. If it's not faster in real-world applications and it nukes my battery faster and potentially cooks my micro SD card, that's not a perk for me. I don't enjoy that. That's not fun. Instead, I think this is a great opportunity to kind of take a look at the longevity of a platform, and this is where I think Valve has done everything right. They found a good baseline, a good balance of performance to power. They flooded the data for people to make accessories, to sell their own kit, to responsibly repair and upgrade their original Steam Decks. And because that's another thing too, is I could pop out the SSD and give myself a 1 terabyte upgrade for pretty cheap. I probably won't. The 512 has been fine, but I could. Again, you can dig into this and keep it going longer. So if we get like a 1-to-1, because I don't want a 1080p OLED. There is an OLED kit for the original Steam Deck, and I don't want that because I think that takes you up to a 1080p resolution. And really, I'd like to stick with this 1280 by 800. If I can find an OLED for that, I'll buy a new fan so that I can get a quieter fan and probably a better performing fan. And I might look at a 1 terabyte upgrade, but at least the screen and the fan would keep me happy for a while on what I like to play when I'm out and about. So I'm so sorry. I know I didn't make it through as many of the comments here. Wes actually had another one. If only we could play Battletoads on it. And yeah, like I kind of have played original Battletoads. It's a stupid hard game. I don't know that I enjoy it. I kind of got spoiled by TMNT Shredder's Revenge. Because, you know, when I can beat that in a single sitting with my eight, well, at the time, she was 7 when we rolled credits. Going back to the harder brawlers, not as much fun. Oh, actually, you know what? I take that back. So Battletoads is just obnoxiously difficult, and it feels rigged against the player. River City Girls. If you like those classic arcadey brawlers, River City Girls is a great arcadey old school brawler. Just so good. Dave Burns. Come on, Juan, you're not some financially responsible guy. Buy the shiny new gadget. Consume. No. I don't know. I mean, I might talk to Marie. She really hasn't. She likes to pick it up and play, but it's not hers to take care of. It's mine. And I think that's also one of the things that she kind of digs. Like,
if there's an issue, I will have fixed it because I care about me maintaining the gadget. But if it's hers, then she's like, oh, I've got to figure this stuff out on my own or install this or where did that shortcut go? And if I bug Juan, he'll get frustrated. I don't know. She hasn't like gotten too lit up about that. But I am trying to find some other just like fun opportunities and fun things for like Lex to play. But she can't really hold and grip and comfortably use the Steam Deck. So for now, it's for her, she typically goes for my Razer Edge. In fact, I found it in her bedroom while I was out of town. It was like I came back and there was this like outline in where dust had kind of like not landed on my night side bedroom table. And like, oh, I guess Lex was playing Shredder's Revenge on my Razer Edge. I wonder where in the house it might be, because I guarantee you it's not charged. Oh, man, it's so good. Oh, Steve Pogue. Yeah, dude, seriously. Steve says, Shredder's Revenge and the Battletoads reboot were so fun, from the gameplay to the visual styles to the music. All of it was so enjoyable for both games. I hope to get both River City Girls. I have both River City Girls. They are harder. They are much harder than Shredder's Revenge, but they are more in keeping with that classic, kind of brawler gameplay. Want to try and see. I don't think it was a McCorkran saying, you mean that BlackBerry miniseries on AMC? I don't think it was a miniseries. It was like a 2-hour movie on the flight. Had the guy from It's Always Sunny. Had Jay Baruchel. Trying to think of the other actors in it. I can't. The cast is like pretty solid. But yeah, I think it was just a movie. I didn't know that there was a miniseries. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Brian, I'm hoping that this gets a little bit more support. RPCS3 is insane for PS3 emulation. If I'm on my beefy workstation, it's pretty good. The most recent updates for RPCS3 have improved the performance on my Nook. So I have that old 9th-gen Core i9 Nook. And I can kind of play PS3 games on that. Like, one of my favorite twin-stick shooter, it's a zombie shooter, Dead Nation, that plays really well on RPCS3. It doesn't play well on the Steam Deck. Like, it loads, it runs, you go through all the menus, everything's clean and sleek, and then the second you get into the gameplay, you get those interrupting chops. Most of the game is playing at like 30 frames per second. It is peaking what the PS3 was capable of on a Steam Deck. But then lots of zombies start rushing you, and it's not even that the frame rate drops. It just like, it's almost like it just locks for a split second, and then it catches up, and then you're dead. If you get to like some of the later levels, like the cemetery mission in Dead Nation, that would be impossible. It would be impossible to complete on the Steam Deck at present. But a little bit more refinement, and maybe it could work. But yeah. We're getting so close to better preserving a lot of those older console games without having to keep the console around. And I'm here for that. I really feel like Sony is starting to put a few games out on PC. You've got an ancient catalog of really fun games that probably would not require a lot of work to bring to the modern era and could just be good trickle income with that Sony Studios logo on it. I don't know. To me, I feel it's like a wasted opportunity not to have some kind of last life for some of those games. Oh, McCorkran, it's fun to tinker, but I don't know that this would be a primary use for me on something like that. McCorkran says, I don't really need a handheld, but sometimes when I'm shopping for like a mini PC or a cheap gaming PC, I think a Steam Deck might be a viable alternative anyway. So in some ways, yes. But for example, like anything that I really like about the Steam Deck, well, for like $499, so less than the price of the 512 gig OLED Steam Deck, you could pick up an AMD mini PC with a beefy, like a 7735 with a Radeon 680M. And if you just wanted a cheap gaming PC, it's all built, 32 gigs of RAM, 512 gigs of storage. You can add another SSD if you want, like another 4 terabytes
I think these, you know, like you can get an SSD, sorry, a SATA SSD to like 8 TB for like less than the price of the 1 TB OLED Steam Deck. So I would still maybe lean in that direction if you really think my gaming is only going to happen at home. But if you think you might occasionally take it out of your home, there is nothing about a gaming laptop that I prefer now. On a gaming laptop, I really can't sustain a better gaming experience unless I can plug it in. And that's what takes me away from the portability argument, is that I don't really have a gaming laptop. I have a gaming portable desktop. But a Steam Deck is a proper portable. When I did the review on the MSI Creator, the most recent MSI Creator, the second you unplug the Creator, all of the games I could play were worse than playing them on the Steam Deck when it was running just off of battery power. Like, the CPU and the GPU in that thing are insane, but they need juice from the wall outlet to sustain that kind of performance. And the second you go off of batteries, they do not let you tap into all that performance. So I look at gaming laptops as really good ways to maybe buy an inexpensive portable workstation, but I don't think they're that great for gaming anymore. Depends on the kind of games you like to play and where you are likely to game on them and whether or not you have access to power. But again, the second I pick up a Steam Deck, it is so immediate. I have proper play, pause, suspend for the games. It is never locked up on me in any grand degree. I have just as much support for different accessories, for audio devices, controllers, docks, displays, XR glasses. And it'll play games pretty similarly to that gaming laptop when it's running on its own battery power. So, short story, incredibly long. I am so excited. I am so happy that Valve actually lived up to their word. This is not Steam Deck 2. This is Steam Deck OLED. And it brings a number of improvements. I am so happy to see all of these improvements. And I don't feel any burning, crushing pressure that I need to have one. If anything, it's just kind of encouraging me to find other ways to update and improve my current Steam Deck, make it a little nicer, but I can just rock with this until it really does feel like it's time to move on and switch out this device for something different. I really like that. That is a great commentary on portable electronics and mobile gaming. And I really think that's the way it should be. I really wish some of our smartphone manufacturers would look at some of those relationships and say, like, oh, you know what? We could keep the same performance for your phone and you could get 20% more battery life out of it. Do you care if your apps open a fraction of a millisecond faster? No. Do you care that your phone can run for a whole extra day of your kind of use? Cool. We can do that. And I wish that we could make that conversation a little more popular and a little sexier so that consumers could really understand, like, why do I care that this year's phone is more powerful than last year's phone? I do things with it that I want it to be more powerful, but I'm kind of an outlier in that I like to shoot family movies on my phone and edit them while I'm shooting them. So that's me. But that doesn't seem to be anyone else. Dave Burns, Valve lives up to their word. Cough, cough. Google, cough, cough. Well, the Google built their reputation on killing all their really fun experiments and stuff. So, folks, I think that's where we're going to wrap it up. I still ran this one a little bit long, and I can feel it in my throat, especially having recently gotten off of an airplane. There's going to be some wacky stuff coming to the channel. I have no idea what the publication is going to look like over the next week, just with finishing up some family stuff and then also talking to TK in a remote location on Thursday. I can't tell you what that will be, but I'm pretty sure most of the people in here could guess what it might be. And then I've got some follow-ups and some commentary videos. Like I said, I'm going to do that silly NAS upgrade. I'm going to have some more things to say about the Pixel 8 Pro and the OnePlus Open. I'm really fighting against doing a OnePlus Open camera review because of this issue that I see in low light photography, but everything else about the OnePlus Open is so good. I kind of want to get ahead of it. Maybe I'll do the bulk of it and then try and do a follow-up if the night mode is addressed in a future update. But there's a lot. So while we keep saying, like, oh, Techtober, and now we're through Techtober, it really hasn't slowed down. Oh, I'm going to be doing another battery, solar panels. I had a project for a 3D printer. That might fall through, but it could be a fun thing, like a fun thing to do with a 3D printer. And then I also got this funky wristband that does like bio vibration feedback to help change your mood or relax you. We're going to tinker with your brain with low frequency vibrations on your wrist. I like tinkering with my brain, so stay tuned. It's going to get weird. I love it. Okay, folks. Thank you, everybody, all of the support. I really appreciate y'all letting me take the time at the beginning of this podcast to kind of talk through some of my feelings on some recent family issues. And I hope some of that resonates with the crew of people that I see here. I have to believe that we're probably like-minded and sharing these ideas and sharing these thoughts with our families and friends. So I really do appreciate that. Again, a major thank you. One more fanfare on our way out. Gary the Fireman and all the people who have subscribed and supported the podcast and shared the podcast, courtesy of one Mr. Barry Johnson. That one's for you. And folks, I want you to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I want you to take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of others. Catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. And I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.